The Enterprise is orbiting a red-brown planet. A red light on the con flashes as the starship hits turbulence.
Stay on top of it, Mr. Sulu.
We're holding orbit, sir. The helm is sluggish.
Scotty grips the engineer's console.
Control circuits threatening to overload, Captain.
Understood, engineer.
Spark.
I can't avoid these areas of turbulence.
I believe we'll have them plotted in a few more orbits, Captain.
Sick bay, to bridge.
Switching to manual, Captain. Do we maintain this orbit?
Spark. This is of great scientific importance, Captain. We're actually passing through ripples in time.
Maintain orbit.
Aye, dear.
Open the channel to Starfleet Command.
Precautionary measure, Lieutenant. Broadcast to Starfleet Command my past week's log entry, starting with the unusual readings we had on the instruments and how they led us here. Inform Starfleet Command that apparently something or someone down on this planet... Boss. ...can affect changes in time, causing turbulent waves of space displacement.
Sulu's unconscious.
Some heart flutter. I better risk a few drops of cordrazine.
It's tricky stuff. Are you sure you want to risk...
McCoy injects Sulu in the throat with the cordrazine, and he instantly comes round with a blissful smile on his face.
You were about to make a medical comment, Jim.
Who, me, Doctor?
We're guiding around most of the time ripples now, Captain.
Mr. Spock.
All plotted but one, Captain. Coming up on it now. Seems to be fairly heavy displacement.
The bridge is rocked by more turbulence. McCoy falls on his hypodermic, injecting cordrazine into his stomach.
Halt!
Back to your positions.
The hypo, Captain.
We're set for cordrazine.
Empty.
Communications, emergency medical team.
McCoy jerks upright.
Killers! Assassins! I won't let you! I'll kill you first! I won't let you!
McCoy throws off Spock and Kirk.
You will get me! Murderers! Killers!
He races into the lift, throwing a hapless medic at Spock and Kirk.
Security alert. Space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the starship Enterprise. Its 5-year mission, to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
Star Trek, created by Gene Roddenberry. Starring William Shatner, also starring Leonard Nimoy as Mr. Spock. The City on the Edge of Forever.
Captain's log, supplemental entry. 2 drops of cordrazine can save a man's life. 100 times that amount has just accidentally been pumped into Dr. McCoy's body. And in a strange, wild frenzy, he has fled the ship's bridge. All connecting decks have been placed on alert. We have no way of knowing if the madness is permanent or temporary or in what direction it will drive McCoy.
The doors to the transporter room slide open, revealing McCoy with a crazed, wide-eyed stare. He creeps up behind the lieutenant working at the control console. He knocks the lieutenant out with 2 swift karate chops, takes a small phaser from his belt, and reaches for the transporter controls. Kirk comes onto the bridge.
Continue alert.
Decks 4 through 11. Medical department knows as little as we do. In dosages approaching this, there's some record of wild paranoia.
Confirmed by the library record tapes, Captain. Subjects failed to recognize acquaintances, became hysterically convinced that they were in mortal danger and were seeking escape at any cost. Extremely dangerous to himself or to anyone else who might...
Bridge, security, alert, alert.
Bridge here, go ahead.
Security, 054, sir. We just found the transporter chief injured. Captain.
Dr. McCoy has beamed himself down to the planet.
And the transporter at that time, Captain, was focused on the center of the time disturbance.
So whatever's down there, McCoy's in the heart of it. Set up a landing party. Let's go get him.
Kirk out.
Kirk strides off the bridge. Kirk, Spock, Scotty, Uhura, and two security officers beam down to the planet's surface. They find themselves in an arid, rocky environment close to the remains of ancient stone temples. The ruins are dominated by an irregular, donut-shaped ring that stands upright amid the broken columns and pediments.
These ruins extend to the horizon.
They look around warily.
Begin recording.
Recording, sir.
Kirk leads them towards the ruins.
And of considerable age, on the order of 10,000 centuries old.
Detail, fan out.
Kirk stands before the ring, which is twice his height.
What is this thing, Mr. Spock? It seems to be pulsating with power of some kind. Analysis, please.
Unbelievable, Captain.
That's funny.
This single object is the source of all the time displacement.
Explain.
I can't. For this to do what it does is impossible by any science I understand.
They circle the bronze-colored object.
It is operating even now. Putting out waves and waves of time displacement, which we picked up millions of miles away.
Landing party to Enterprise. No sign of Dr. McCoy. Search progressing.
As Uhura and a security officer pass a rock, McCoy pops up from behind it, looking like a hunted animal. He runs in the opposite direction.
Incredible power. It can't be a machine as we understand mechanics.
Then what is it?
A question.
The ring lights up in time with the voice.
Since before your sun burned hot in space, and before your race was born, I have awaited a question.
Kirk takes a step forward.
What are you?
I am the guardian of forever.
Are you machine or being?
I am both and neither. I am my own beginning, my own ending.
I see no reason for answers to be couched in riddles.
My answer is simply as your level of understanding makes possible.
Scotty and the other armed security officer edge past some broken columns and a crumbling wall. McCoy is crouched down on the other side. He waits for them to pass, then runs off the other way, at the ring.
A time portal, Captain. A gateway to other times and dimensions, if I'm correct.
As correct as possible for you. Your science knowledge is obviously primitive.
Really?
Annoyed, Spock?
Behold.
A curtain of mist drops down over the hole in the ring.
A gateway to your own past, if you wish.
Through the mist are moving images of Earth's history. Ancient Egypt, the Romans.
Killers!
A deranged McCoy races towards them.
Killers! I won't let you get me! I'll kill you first! I won't let you get me. Assassins! Murderers! Killers!
The security officer sees McCoy and Spock knocks him out with a Vulcan nerve pinch. Kirk looks back to see images of knights on horseback within the ring.
Spock! If that is a doorway back through time, could we somehow take Bones back a day in time, then
relive the accident? This time be certain that the hypo-accident is avoided.
They look at the ring as the images change.
Look at the speed with which the centuries are passing, Captain. To step through on precisely the day we wish.
Guardian! Can you change the speed at which yesterday passes?
I was made to offer the past in this manner. I cannot change.
The ring is showing images of cannon fire and charging troops from the American Civil War.
Strangely compelling, isn't it? To step through there and lose oneself in another world.
I am a fool. Our tricorder is capable of recording even at this speed. I've missed taping centuries of living history which no man before has ever...
Dr. McCoy! Bones, no!
Kirk makes a belated attempt to rugby tackle him as McCoy leaps through the ring and disappears. The mist vanishes.
Where is he?
He has passed into what was.
Captain, I've lost contact with the ship. I was talking to them. Suddenly it went dead. No static, just nothing.
Kirk to Enterprise. Scotty.
Kirk hands Uhura's communicator to Spock. Scotty takes out his communicator.
Nothing wrong with the communicator, sir.
Your vessel, your beginning. All that you knew is gone.
The landing party look at the Guardian of Forever, stunned.
McCoy has somehow changed history.
You mean we're stranded down here?
With no past, no future.
Captain, I'm frightened.
Earth's not there, at least not the Earth we know. We're totally alone.
Kirk slowly looks up at the stars above his head.
Captain's log, no star date. For us, time does not exist. McCoy, back somewhere in the past, has effected a change in the course of time. All Earth history has been changed. There is no Starship Enterprise. We have only one chance. We have asked the Guardian to show us Earth's history again. Spock and I will go back into time ourselves and attempt to set right whatever it was that McCoy changed.
I was recording images at the time McCoy left. A rather barbaric period in your American history. I believe I can approximate just when to jump. Perhaps within a month of the correct time. A week, if we're fortunate.
Make sure we arrive before McCoy got there. It's vital we stop him. Before he does whatever it was that changed all history.
As Spock adjusts his tricorder, Kirk stares into the ring.
Guardian, if we are successful...
Then you will be returned. It will be as though none of you had gone.
Kirk goes up to Uhura, Scotty, and the two security officers.
Captain, it seems impossible. Even if you're able to find the right date...
Then even finding McCoy would be a miracle.
There is no alternative.
Scotty. When you think you've waited long enough, each of you will have to try it. Even if you fail, at least you'll be alive in some past world somewhere. Aye.
Seconds now, sir. Stand by.
Good luck, gentlemen.
Happiness at least, sir.
Kirk strides towards the ring, which shows images of a partial newspaper headline reading, "Declares War," a man addressing a crowd, and a blizzard of ticker tape.
And now.
Kirk and Spock leap through the ring and disappear. They reappear on a run-down American city street in the 1930s and watch in amazement as shabbily dressed people and cars go by. Behind them is a poster advertising boxing at Madison Square Garden.
I've seen old photographs of this period. An economic upheaval had occurred.
It was called Depression, circa 1930. Quite barbaric.
Two passing women stare at the colorful Starfleet uniforms. Spock turns away and tries to hide his pointed ears.
We seem to be costumed a little out of step with the time.
I'm afraid I'm going to be difficult to explain in any case, Captain.
Well, Mr. Spock, if we can't disguise you, we'll find some way of explaining it.
That should prove interesting.
As more people pass by, Kirk and Spock try and fail to look inconspicuous.
Let's get out of here.
They cross the street. A boxy black car with big chrome headlights screeches to a halt.
Fast.
Look out, will you? Why don't you watch where you're going?
Spock looks back at the driver who narrowly avoided running him down. Kirk grabs him and points up at some clothes drying on a fire escape balcony.
Theft, Captain?
Well, we'll steal from the rich and give back to the poor later.
Spock watches as Kirk scampers up the fire escape ladder. He helps himself to the drab clothes hanging over the balcony and climbs back down. Spock raises his eyebrows slightly and goes to meet his captain at the foot of the ladder.
I think I'm going to like this century. Simple, easier to manage. We're not going to have any difficulty explaining.
A policeman with an enormous baton behind his back blocks their path.
Well?
You're a police officer. I recognize the traditional accoutrements.
Kirk glances at Spock.
You were saying you'll have no trouble explaining it.
My friend is obviously Chinese. I see you've noticed the ears. They're actually easy to explain.
He turns to Spock at a loss.
Perhaps the unfortunate accident I had as a child.
The unfortunate accident he had as a child. He caught his head in a mechanical rice picker. But fortunately, there was an American missionary living close by who was actually a skilled plastic surgeon in civilian life.
All right. Drop those bundles and put your hands on that wall there. Come on!
He frisks Kirk.
Oh, how careless of your wife to let you go out that way.
What? Oh, yes, it's quite untidy here. Let me help you.
Spock drops the policeman with a Vulcan nerve pinch. The small crowd that has gathered stare as Kirk grabs the bundle of clothes and he and Spock run. They turn a corner and tear along the street, running past a queue of people lining up outside a soup kitchen. They duck into an alleyway, hurry down some basement steps, and come into a dusty, dingy basement, cluttered with old furniture. Kirk crosses the basement and looks out at a window set high up in the wall, then puts the clothes down on a table.
You were actually enjoying my predicament back there. At times, you seem quite human.
Captain, I hardly believe that insults are within your prerogative as my commanding officer.
Sorry.
They change into the clothes.
Time we face the unpleasant facts.
First, I believe we have about a week before McCoy arrives, but we can't be certain.
Arrives where? Honolulu, Boise, San Diego? Why not Outer Mongolia, for that matter?
There is a theory. There could be some logic to the belief that time is fluid, like a river with currents, eddies, backwash.
And the same currents that swept McCoy to a certain time and place might sweep us there, too.
Unless that is true, Captain, we have no hope. Frustrating. Locked in here is the exact place and moment of his arrival. Even the images of what he did. If only I could tie this tricorder in with the ship's computers for just a few moments.
Couldn't you build some form of computer aid here?
In this zinc-plated, vacuum-tubed culture.
Yes, well, it would pose an extremely complex problem in logic, Mr. Spock.
Spock raises an eyebrow with a faint trace of indignation.
Excuse me. I sometimes expect too much of you.
The lights come on.
Who's there?
Spock hurriedly pulls a woolly hat over his ears as a woman comes down the stairs.
Excuse us, miss. We didn't mean to trespass. It's cold outside.
A lie is a very poor way to say hello. It isn't that cold.
No. We were being chased by a policeman.
Why?
These clothes. We stole them. We didn't have any money.
Kirk and the beautiful dark-haired woman in the starched white apron gaze at each other.
Well, I could do with some help around here. Doing dishes, sweeping, general cleaning.
At what rate of payment? I need radio tubes and so forth, my hobby.
Kirk's mystified look turns to one of comprehension.
15 cents an hour for 10 hours a day. What are your names?
Mine's Jim Kirk. His is... Spock.
I'm Edith Keeler. Well, you can start by cleaning up down here.
Excuse me, miss. Where are we?
You're in the 21st Street Mission.
Do you run this place?
Indeed I do, Mr. Kirk.
She leaves. Spock looks innocent as Kirk turns to him.
Radio tubes. And so on. I approve of hobbies, Mr. Spock.
In the mission canteen, Kirk and Spock queue for soup and bread. The mission is set out with tables where shabbily dressed men in hats hungrily devour their meager meals. Kirk and Spock shuffle along the narrow gap between the two tables nearest to the door to the street and sit down. Edith breezes in.
Good evening.
She climbs onto a stage and stands next to a piano.
You'll be sorry.
Why?
You expect to eat for free or something? You gotta listen to Goody Two-Shoes.
And now, as I'm sure that somebody out there has said, it's time to pay for the soup.
Not that she's a bad-looking broad, but if she really wanted to help out a fella in need.
Shut up. Shut up. I want to hear what she has to say.
Yes, of course, Captain.
Now, let's start by getting one thing straight. I'm not a do-gooder. If you're a bum, if you can't break off with a booze or whatever it is that makes you a bad risk, then get out. Now, I don't pretend to tell you how to find happiness and love when every day is just a struggle to survive. But I do insist that you do survive, because the days and the years ahead are worth living for. One day, soon, man is going to be able to harness incredible energies, maybe even the atom. Energies that could ultimately hurl us to other worlds in some sort of spaceship. And the men that reach out into space will be able to find ways to feed the hungry millions of the world and to cure their diseases. They will be able to find a way to give each man hope and a common future. And those are the days worth living for. Our deserts will bloom.
Development of atomic power is years away. Space flight years after that.
Now it speculation. Gifted insight.
But it will come.
I find her most uncommon, Mr. Spock.
Prepare for tomorrow. Get ready. Don't give up.
Later, Spock, Kirk, and the down-and-outs return their dishes to the kitchen counter. The two time travelers are heading back to their table when Edith rushes in behind them.
Mr. Kirk! You are uncommon workmen. That basement looks like it's been scrubbed and polished.
Then we can report back for other work.
Yes, 7 o'clock in the morning. Do you have a flop for the night?
What?
You really are new at this, aren't you? A flop is a place to sleep.
Oh.
Well, there's a vacant room at the place where I live for $2 a week. If you want to, I'll take you there.
Thank you.
They gaze at one another. She leaves with a smile on her face. Kirk brings his own smile under control and turns to Spock.
We have a flop.
We have a what, Captain?
A place to sleep.
One might have said so in the first place.
A gnarled old man passes between them, stroking his long, white, wispy beard. Later, in a room in Edith's boarding house in a rundown part of town, a current of blue light rises up to antennae connected to some circuit boards that Spock has cannibalized from a collection of radio valves, coils, and resistors, and wired up to his tricorder, which is adjusting with a knife. The door opens and Spock goes to put his hat on, but stops when he sees that it's Kirk with some shopping bags.
Captain, I must have some platinum. A small block would be sufficient, 5 or 6 pounds. By passing certain circuits through there to be used as a duodynetic field core.
Mr. Spock, I've brought you some assorted vegetables, bologna and a hard roll for myself, and I've spent the other 9/10 of our combined salaries for the last 3 days on filling this order for you. Mr. Spock, this bag does not contain platinum, silver, or gold, nor is it likely to in the near future.
Captain, you're asking me to work with equipment which is hardly very far ahead of stone knives and bearskins.
McCoy will be along in a few days, perhaps sooner. There's no guarantee that these currents in time will bring us together. This has to work.
Captain. Captain, in 3 weeks, at this rate, possibly a month, I might reach the first mnemonic memory circuits.
Cap.
If you can leave right away, I can get you 5 hours' work at 22 cents an hour.
She notices the blue light pulsing up the antennae and frowns.
What on earth is that?
I am endeavoring, ma'am, to construct a mnemonic memory circuit using stone knives and bearskins.
She shrugs, wide-eyed but trustingly. Kirk shoots a disapproving look at Spock and gestures for Edith to lead the way. Spock, still with his woolen hat over his ears, grabs his coat, and they follow her. Later, at a table in the mission canteen, a down-and-out wears a magnifying eyepiece as he repairs a cuckoo clock using a selection of fine tweezers, screwdrivers, and files. Kirk and Spock are sweeping the floor.
Captain.
Spock beckons Kirk over and points at the man repairing the cuckoo clock.
Tools for finely detailed work.
Later, in a darkened room, Spock turns the dial on a combination padlock attached to a metal box. Later still, Edith storms down to the basement stairs where Spock and Kirk are standing by the furnace.
That toolbox was locked with a combination lock, and you opened it like a real pro. Why did you do it?
I needed the fine tools for my radio work. They'd have been returned in the morning.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Mr. Spock says that he needs the tools and that they'd be returned tomorrow morning, you can bet your reputation on that, Miss Keeler.
Kirk smiles at her, and her stern frown ebbs away.
On one condition. Walk me home? I still have a few questions I'd like to ask about you two. Oh, and don't give me that questions about little old us look. You know as well as I do how out of place you two are around here.
Interesting. Where would you estimate we belong, Miss Keeler?
You? At his side, as if you've always been there and always will. And you? You belong in another place. I don't know where or how. I'll figure it out eventually.
Spock watches as they smile playfully at one another.
I'll finish with the furnace.
Captain. Even when he doesn't say it, he does.
She walks away. Kirk watches her go. Then, as if drawn by a magnetic force, follows her. Spock, shoveling coal into the furnace, turns to watch Kirk leave. As they walk along a street at night, Kirk takes Edith's hand. The music comes from a radio repair shop.
Why does Spock call you Captain? Were you in the war together?
We served together.
And you, don't want to talk about it? Why? Did you do something wrong? Are you afraid of something? Whatever it is, let me help.
Let me help. 100 years or so from now, I believe, a famous novelist will write a classic using that theme. He'll recommend those three words even over I love you.
Centuries from now? Who is he? Where does he come from? Where will he come from?
Silly question. Want to hear a silly answer?
Yes.
A planet circling that far left star in Orion's belt. See?
She gazes up at the stars in wonderment, then turns to Kirk, who looks at her longingly. In the half-light, the Manhattan Bridge is silhouetted against the New York skyline. In their rented room, Spock adjusts the circuitry. The tricorder screen buzzes into life and shows a newspaper article with the headline, "Social Worker Killed," above a photograph of Edith. The picture breaks up and Spock reconnects a component on an attached circuit board. He sits back down in front of the tricorder as Kirk comes in.
How are the stone knives and bearskins?
I may have found our focal point in time.
I think you may also find you have a connection burning someplace.
Yes, I'm overloading those lines. I believe we'll have our answer on this screen, Captain.
Good.
And, Captain, you may find this a bit distressing.
All right, let's see what you have.
I've slowed down the recording we made from the time vortex.
February 23rd, 1936. 6 years from now.
On the tricorder screen is a newspaper headline which reads, FDR confers with slum area angel. Above the headline is a photograph of Edith.
The president and Edith Keeler conferred for some time today.
The picture breaks up. A long circuit board with a row of valves like light bulbs fizzes and sparks as it goes up in smoke.
How bad?
Bad enough.
The president and Edith Keeler.
It would seem unlikely, Jim. A few moments ago, I read a 1930 newspaper article.
We know her future. Within 6 years from now, she'll become very important, nationally famous.
Or, Captain, Edith Keeler will die this year. I saw her obituary.
Kirk looks stunned as he edges closer to his somber-faced science officer.
Some sort of traffic accident.
You must be mistaken. They both can't be true.
Captain, Edith Keeler is the focal point in time we've been looking for. The point in time that both we and Dr. McCoy have been drawn to.
She has two possible futures then. And depending on whether she lives or dies, all of history will be changed. And McCoy
is the random element.
In his condition, what does he do? Does he kill her?
Or perhaps he prevents her from being killed. We don't know which.
Get this thing fixed. We must find out before McCoy arrives.
Captain, suppose we discover that in order to set things straight again, Edith Keeler must die.
Kirk looks solemn. A scruffy, weaselly-looking down-and-out huddles in a doorway as a milkman leaves a bottle of milk on a doorstep in a nearby alley. The milkman leaves on his horse-drawn delivery cart. The unkempt man looks around furtively as he goes down the alleyway and steals the bottle of milk. He looks across the street as he breaks the foil top on the bottle. McCoy appears and runs into the middle of the road.
Assassins! Murderers! Murderers! Assassins!
He spots the startled milk thief.
You! What planet is this?
The man freezes. McCoy, his face glistening with sweat, walks towards the terrified thief, who lets the bottle drop. At the boarding house.
Why? What is so funny about man reaching for the moon?
How do you know?
I just know, that's all. I feel it. And more, I think that one day they're going to take all the money that they spend now on war and death.
And make them spend it on life.
Yes.
Somber-faced, Kirk walks her across the landing to the door of her room. They stop and gaze at one another.
You see the same things that I do. We speak the same language.
The very same.
McCoy grabs the milk thief.
I'm glad you got away too.
Yeah, I...
Why do you think they want to kill us?
Look, fella, you take a sip too much of that old wood alky and almost anything seems like it...
Where are we? Earth. Constellations seem right, but... Explain this trick.
I...
McCoy takes in the shabby suit and cap that the man's wearing. He lets go of the man's arms and pats his thighs.
My bed. Small.
He tears off the man's cap and feels the top of his bald head.
Good cranial development. No doubt considerable human ancestry. Is that how you're able to fake all of this? Very good. Modern me museum perfection. Right down to the cement beams. Very, very good. Oh, I'd give a lot to see the hospital. Probably needles and sutures. Oh, the pity. Used to have to cut and sew people like garments. Needles and sutures. Oh, the pity.
McCoy crumples to the ground. Confused and shocked, the man looks around, then retrieves his cap as he crouches next to the unconscious doctor. He checks McCoy's pockets, finds the Mark I phaser clipped to his belt, and scurries away into the darkness with the phaser. He stops and looks around, then looks down at the phaser, which is about the same size and shape as a mobile phone. He presses a button on it and inadvertently turns it on himself. His body glows a searing bright blue and he disappears. McCoy starts to come round. Kirk comes into the rented room and finds Spock working on some circuitry. Three planks with valves attached to them are connected by cables.
How long before we get a full answer?
I'll need at least two more days before I dare make another attempt.
McCoy could have been in the city a week now, for all we know. And whatever he does that affects her and changes history could happen tonight, tomorrow morning.
Captain, our last bit of information was obtained at the expense of 30 hours' work in fused and burned circuits.
I must know whether she lives or dies, Spock. I must know what to do.
McCoy is wandering the streets in daylight, dazed and confused. Passers-by stare at his Starfleet uniform of blue shirt and tight black trousers tucked into black boots. He notices men drifting into the mission and follows them. Inside, Edith is pouring cups of strong black coffee.
A mess. That coffee, it just smells wonderful.
You look terrible. You better sit down. Come on.
I can't. I gotta keep moving. I can't let them find me.
Oh, there's a cot in the back room. Look, they won't find you there. Come on.
McCoy's face is pale and sweating. Edith puts his arm over her shoulder and helps him out of the canteen. As they leave, Spock comes in and takes over pouring coffee. Later in the rented room, Spock and Kirk appearing at the tricorder screen.
This is how history went after McCoy changed it. Here, in the late 1930s, a growing pacifist movement whose influence delayed the United States' entry into the Second World War. While peace negotiations dragged on, Germany had time to complete its heavy water experiments.
Germany. Fascism. Hitler. Won the Second World War.
Because all this lets them develop the A-bomb first. There's no mistake, Captain. Let me run it again.
Spock rewinds the images.
Edith Keeler, founder of the peace movement.
But she was right. Peace was the way.
She was right, but at the wrong time. With the A-bomb and with their V-2 rockets to carry them, Germany captured the world.
No.
And all this because McCoy came back and somehow kept her from dying in a street accident, as she was meant to. We must stop him, Jim.
Kirk glances at Spock, troubled, gets up, and moves away.
How did she die? What day?
We can estimate general happenings from these images, but I can't trace down precise actions at exact moments, Captain. I'm sorry.
Spock. I believe I'm in love with Edith Keeler.
Jim, Edith Keeler must die.
Kirk is stony-faced. In a room in the mission, Edith is rooting through a filing cabinet. McCoy comes to on a bed behind her.
Hey, now, come on. I'm not ready to take on any tigers just yet, my darling.
She sits on a chair at his side and takes his pulse.
The most common question to ask would be, where am I? I don't think I'll ask it.
Why not?
The only possible answer would conclusively prove that I'm either unconscious or demented.
Ashen-faced, he lifts his head off the pillow and looks around the drab, sparsely furnished room.
This looks like old Earth around 1920 or 25.
Would you care to try for 30?
I am unconscious or demented.
I have a friend that talks about Earth the same way that you do. Would you like to meet him?
I'm a surgeon, not a psychiatrist.
He looks weary, but lifts his head defiantly.
I am Leonard McCoy, senior medical officer aboard the USS Enterprise.
Edith raises her eyebrows doubtfully. McCoy's head falls back onto the pillow.
I don't mean to disbelieve you, but that's hardly a Navy uniform.
It's quite all right. It's quite all right, dear. Because I don't believe in you either.
Get some rest.
She stops and looks back at McCoy, who's fallen asleep. Night falls over Manhattan. Kirk is at the door to his room watching Edith go up the stairs.
Edith?
She stops and turns round.
Are you following me, sir?
With ulterior motives, if that please you.
I hope it means what...
Watched by Spock, she stumbles and Kirk catches her.
Stupid, I've been up and down those stairs 1,000 times. I could have broken my neck.
Kirk gazes at her unblinkingly. She smiles and kisses him on the lips. Unseen by either of them, Spock slips discreetly back into the room. Edith breaks off from the kiss and goes upstairs. Kirk trudges down the stairs in a daze like a love-struck adolescent. Spock comes back out of the room.
Captain, I did not plan to eavesdrop.
No, of course you didn't.
I must point out that when she stumbled, she might have died right there had you not caught her.
It's not yet time. McCoy isn't here.
We're not that sure of our facts. Who's to say when the exact time will come? Save her. Do as your heart tells you to do. And millions will die who did not die before.
Kirk glances at Spock, then walks away. At the mission, a refreshed-looking McCoy is in his room, drinking coffee.
Come in.
Well, you look just fine, Doctor.
Thank you.
I thought you might like to see the evening paper.
No, not particularly. You know, I've convinced myself that this is all in a quadricine hallucination. But I've decided you're not.
That's reassuring.
But if you're not, what are you?
A friend. When you showed up here, you looked like you could use one.
No, I don't doubt it. What about this place? You run it?
I try to.
Why?
It's necessary.
Well, it was for me, at least. You may have saved my life.
Lots of people drink from the wrong bottle sometimes.
Not as wrong as the bottle I drank from. Allow me to show my gratitude. Perhaps there's something I can do around here to thank you.
Oh, we can talk about that later. I have to go. My young man is taking me to a Clark Gable movie.
A who movie?
A Clark Gable. Don't you know?
Well, I know what a movie is, but...
That's very strange. You get some rest. I'll see you later.
McCoy smiles after her. He looks at the newspaper and frowns. Later, Edith and Kirk come out of the mission and cross the litter-strewn street. They jump back as a car screeches to a halt.
Oh.
Who is behind hurry, maybe we can catch the Clark Gable movie at the Orpheum.
I'd what?
Really love to see it. You know, Dr. McCoy said the same
McCoy.
Thing.
McCoy? Leonard McCoy?
Yes. He's in the mission. He's...
Stay right here. Spock! Stay right there.
Kirk tears back across the street.
What is it? McCoy, he's a... Oh!
The three of them embrace. Edith starts across the street to join them.
No, Jim!
A truck bears down on her. Kirk, who held McCoy back as he tried to push Edith out of the path of the truck, clings to the doctor with his eyes screwed shut.
You deliberately stopped me, Jim. I could have saved her. Do you know what you just did?
Kirk looks stunned as he pushes McCoy away.
He knows, Doctor. He knows.
Kirk leans against a wall, his fist trembling as he suppresses his emotions. Later, back in their Starfleet uniforms, Spock and Kirk leap out of the mist and through the ring.
What happened, sir? You only left a moment ago.
McCoy leaps through the ring.
We were successful.
Scotty and Uhura stare at Kirk's dark, brooding expression.
Time has resumed its shape. All is as it was before. Many such journeys are possible. Let me be your gateway.
Captain, the Enterprise is up there. They're asking if we want to beam up.
With difficulty, the captain pulls his thoughts back to the present.
Let's get the hell out of here.
The seven strong landing party take up their positions. They beam up. On the planet's surface, the time portal, the guardian of forever, stands silent amidst the ancient stone ruins. This audio description was written and produced at IMS for the Sci-Fi Channel.